Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present a very special episode of Who Killed Amy Mahalovic, featuring Nick and the captain of the True Crime Garage podcast.
Amy was last seen at the Bay Village Square shopping plaza, a popular after-school hangout for kids. She reportedly told classmates it was here that she was to meet a family friend who would take her on a shopping spree.
I've always taught them the rules. You never go with anyone anywhere, but that's how we got through her soft heart. She wanted to do something for Mom, and it was supposed to be kept a secret.
It's touched me very, very deeply. I feel for this family tremendously, and I feel very worried for the safety of all the children in Bay and everywhere.
Bay Village police and the FBI aren't thumbing their nose at any clues, including the remotest of possible leads. Right now, time is the enemy, as the abductor's trail grows colder by the day.
It's been almost a week since her 10-year-old daughter was abducted by a man who looks like this. He reportedly told Amy he was a friend of the family and would take her to buy a gift for her mother. Brandon says the abductor may have confided in someone about the crime or sought to use them as an alibi, and that person may now be in danger.
Parents, teachers, and religious leaders will be helping youngsters cope with their fears and questions for a long time, yet counselors know that many of the questions will never be answered.
Police describe the man as white, in his early 30s, about 5'9", of medium build, with dark hair, a bald spot in the back, and round glasses. One of Amy's friends reportedly told police that Amy said she was to meet someone who claimed to be a friend of the family to go buy her mother a surprise gift.
And part of the con involved luring Amy to the Bay Village shopping plaza. A phone call to Amy led her to believe the suspect was a friend of the family who wanted to buy her mom a surprise gift to celebrate a job promotion.
I'd say rather than being frustrated, these people are determined, and that shows. They just keep trying as hard as they can and doing everything possible.
The search for Amy has lasted for 4 months. This picture of the Bay Village girl has been placed in every public place possible with the hope that someone, somewhere, would have information leading to her whereabouts.
A female jogger was jogging this morning at approximately 7:30, and she spotted something in the field and went off the field and checked, and it was a body.
The body of a young female found in Anson County early Thursday morning has been identified as that of Amy Mahalovic, age 12, of Bay Village of Ohio.
Hello and welcome to episode 89 of Who Killed Amy Mahalovic. I am your host, Bill Huffman, and this is a Slow Burn Media production. On this week's episode, I'll be wrapping up my conversation with Nick and the Captain of the True Crime Garage podcast, as we discuss the case of Amy Mahalovic. This past Tuesday marked 31 years since Amy was abducted from Bay Village Plaza in Bay Village, Ohio, a town of just 17,000 people. And we would all like to see resolution to this case. And there's been a number of documentaries, there's been a number of podcasts, been a number of specials on this case, as well as news segments, and again, all we want to do is see a resolution and the perpetrator brought to justice. So join me this week as I conclude my conversation with Nick and the Captain. But in the meantime, if you guys do have any tips, please contact the Bay Village Police Department at 440-871-1234. Or you can contact the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. Let's jump into my conversation with Nick and the Captain on this week's episode of Who Killed Amy Mahalovic. All right, so let's back up to the two people that were told about the phone call. What the hell were they thinking when she was told, when she told them, hey, I got a phone call from this person who says she works with my dad. He says he works with my mom. We're going to go buy a gift together. I mean, what if you were 10 years old, what would your reaction have been to that kid? Like, no, don't do that. That doesn't sound like a smart thing to do. Or would you just shut up and just not say anything? I mean, again,
all that sounds nice. That's
okay. Know, that's honest.
Especially at 10.
I think the problem with that is they believed it because she believed it. I mean, they're hearing it from her. They're not experiencing that phone call. They're not the one that's walking to the plaza to meet this man. I think it's just an oh, by the way kind of thing that you go, oh, wait, now it means something 24 hours later.
Right.
It didn't mean so much when we were just having casual conversation before.
But it's also the term. I'm going to meet a guy that's friends with my mom.
And that sets a false sense of security.
Well, so I think they could assume that you know this person. You might just not know his name. Because how many people worked with, you know, my mother or my father that I saw five or six times and couldn't remember their name?
Well, she only worked with two males, so.
No, but what I'm saying is the kids that are receiving the information.
Right.
They probably knew a couple people that worked with their mother or worked with their father and were like, I know some people, but I don't know their names.
I can confidently tell you that I was definitely in that. I mean, know how that if every kid was. I mean, who the hell knows their parents' names?
I mean, and heck, you might know what your parents' job title is, but you might not know what the hell they do.
No kidding.
Like, okay, so you're this. Well, what does that actually mean?
I think it took me 25 years to figure out what my dad did as a banker.
Yeah, and if somebody that worked with my father would have drove up to my house and I was shooting basketballs, you know, shooting hoops, and he pulled up and said, hey, you got to get in the car. I got to go take you to see your dad at work. I would have been like, okay. All right, so here we go. But that's where I question, though, is like, and I'm not saying that this guy is a moron, but I'm just saying that there's, if you really had this planned out, again, okay, I can get you to meet me at the plaza. I'm going to figure out what route you're going to take, and I'm going to drive my car up and meet you at that route. You know, intersect you before you get to the plaza where there's a bunch of people that can see what I look like or see what my car is. So,
and I think that's what goes to my thought of him being in disguise to a degree, you know, or just not from the area, because of the fact that this is somebody who's most likely, if he's from Bay, is going to be recognized. And it's a small town. We're talking a city of 15,000 people. We're not talking a major metropolitan area. I mean, if you recognize, you're going to recognize this individual. And the problem is that this individual, like, you look at the sketch, and the sketch is basically what anybody from 1989 looked like. You know, that is what a 30-year-old person looked like. I mean, you could open up a whatever photo book from the year of 1989, and that was the style: a polo shirt or a members only jacket, big hair, and
but we're also assuming that the call was pretty short though, right? The initial call.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I mean there was enough information relayed to tell her that they would have $45 to spend if there was.
Well, because I'm also doing something that I don't like doing, is having a theory and then trying to make my theory work. But in the sake of doing that, again, with the planning, you get the girl on the phone and the plan might have came out as you were talking to her. There might have been a set idea before, then all of a sudden, oh yeah, by the way, your mom had this promotion, and
like he just sort of stumbled upon it. Like, he didn't actually think she would actually pick up and be able to have a conversation with him, and was sort of winging it, is what you're saying?
Yeah, possibly. Or maybe he had multiple thoughts, because I do think this guy, I don't know if planning is the right word, but I would default to Nick. I think Nick has a better gut sense than maybe I do, but I think the planning was more like constant daydreaming about this stuff. And so when he got in the moment, this ruse of, we'll buy your mom a gift, that was something that he thought about a bunch. But I don't think that might have been his only plan. But I don't think this guy was sitting down with a pad of paper and mapping everything out and trying to come up with the greatest ideas. I think a lot of these plan, this is stuff that he thought about, you know. I want to do this one day. Oh, how would I do that? Next day, he's thinking of a different ruse. He's thinking of a different idea. And he probably did this a lot. As some kind of weird perversion or something.
How do you feel about that, Nick? Because I think of like a guy in his basement, if that's the case. Okay, like this is who I'm going after. You know, if the planning's... I'm with you on the planning side of things. I think this was more planned out, but I do think I'm with the captain, and both of you agree on this one, that once she put up a fight or basically put a stop to whatever he was going to try to do, that's when everything went to hell in a handbasket.
Well, no, I think we agree on the planning, but I think we, you know, how he did it, we'd never know. But I think this individual probably spent a lot of time driving around, seeing people ride their bikes and then getting ideas.
Sure.
And it wasn't, like Nick said, could I just grab this individual? His urge wasn't enough to make him do that. And he was smart enough to go, well, I don't know if that's the best way to get a victim.
Yeah, I think his lack of impulsiveness, the patience that is shown here, I think does in fact point toward a certain level of intelligence, or at least criminal sophistication.
Do you feel like the ability to talk to a young girl the way, you know, since we know that the conversation wasn't all that thorough, but you know, it wasn't like they spoke for 30 minutes or something, but then again, we don't know for a fact, but we do know that it was a local call. Do you feel that that ability to talk to somebody young is something that he could have learned in one of his professions or going to school or worked around kids
or sad enough to think has kids of their own?
That part is a little disturbing too. And I think both are disturbing. And I think what's really disturbing about this thing is that there probably was a plan, the third place, where we don't know if they ever made it to the third place. You know, like the third place is the car technically, but let's say there's the fourth place. Now the fourth place ended up being Ashland. Okay. But what would have happened if they made it to from the third place to the fourth place? And that's where I think there was a plan, and that's why they ended up down where they ended up. I don't feel like it was a random spot. I feel like it was someplace this individual absolutely knew where he was going with Amy. But if you look at the autopsy report, I've discussed it with Nick. I've demonstrated on Nick at CrimeCon, I think, even about my theory about how she possibly was killed in the vehicle, because of the fact that she probably put up a fight and there was, you know, skull fractures and the stab wounds were to the left side of the neck. And, you know, that just goes to a passenger sitting in a car seat or, you know, a car next to the driver. And let's say she starts freaking out and is trying to grab the steering wheel and he's got a pocket knife and he, you know, because the wounds are only 2 inches, but they go to the bone. But he's
right.
You know, like let's say he's just freaking out and he gets her three times in the aorta, and man, there's blood everywhere. And not to get too graphic, but like that car and that crime. I mean, I think that's what's weird about it, because that kind of throws off my theory to the fact that she got killed in the car, because her clothes weren't covered in blood, were they? Nick, do you remember the autopsy report?
So it appears that she was.
She had
at some point during this whole ordeal, she was undressed and then redressed.
Okay.
There's evidence to support that very strongly.
I wonder if
that's why they've always never fully said that she was sexually assaulted, but never have said that she wasn't.
But that's where I believe.
Because that puts 100% a sexual component into the whole thing, whether she was actually violated physically or not.
That's why I believe she got to whatever location they were supposed to.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean she was killed there.
No.
I really do think that this individual thought there was going to be some kind of relationship.
That's what I agree with you on
and,
that.
And so there could have been a molestation. There could have been just
an attempt.
I'm going to watch you take a shower. Okay, now you get redressed. Or, you know, now let's get back in the car. I mean, the killing could still, you could still get to the second location or the location that he was planning to take her, and she could still have died somewhere, been murdered somewhere else.
I guess my question really relies on the insinuation part, you know, the bleeding out, the fact that she bled out as her cause of death. I'm sorry, but like, knowing the Ashland area, knowing what's around there, I mean, it's a hunting mecca. I mean, this is where you would go to get your kill dressed and or whatever you do when you go to a butcher. But there's got to be, it just leads me to believe that there is some place that she bled out and then she was put back in her clothes and then dropped at this location.
Yeah.
And that must have taken some. So there it is. There's your answer to, or an answer to my question about when she or where she was killed. She at least made it to that other spot where her clothes were taken off. Because you can't imagine that happened in the car.
Well, unless it was a van or something like that.
Well, that's true. Ban the van.
Ban the van. No, but again, also I think, and I don't want to keep arguing with Nick because that's what we do on our show. I think Nick's right. This guy is not, I'm not calling him a dummy. I'm just saying the average intelligence, maybe a little bit less than that. Not like the guy can't read or write.
Do you think it's weird that there have been no suspects named at all other than through writers and Renner? And
well, let's make sure we circle back to that, because I do want to answer you were talking about the exsanguination.
Well, yeah, let's continue with that. Let's go ahead. That's fine.
So, and I think you bring up a very valid point and something that is very interesting in talking about, was this a murder that took place in the vehicle or in another location? And I think the exsanguination almost points, I mean, it technically could have happened in either a vehicle or another location. But one thing that we have to keep in mind is the general rule is that the amount of blood in a person's body is roughly 10% of their weight. Okay. And I believe that the medical term for the medical definition of using the term exsanguination on someone is that the majority of the blood in the body is not no longer there. So let's say that requires, and I think it's actually even more so than that. Like, I don't think that they just loosely throw that term around, because it is something that's very specific. If you were to take it to, like, you know, level of like Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, it would mean that the body was completely, that had no blood in it at all. But I think as far as the medical field goes, it would suggest that it's over that of 60%. So if that is in fact the term that they're choosing to use, that means that somewhere, and there's no nice way of putting it, somewhere there was a lot of this child's blood.
Is there any evidence that she was choked?
I only know of the stab wounds to the neck and the blunt force trauma to the head as far as above the shoulder wounds.
And so I think one thing that we need to keep in mind here too is that, Bill, you're absolutely right. Everything in the autopsy itself shows us that this is some kind of, this is reactionary. The offender reacted to something that was going on or not going on, and the attack happened. And because he's a grown man and she's a child, he got the best of her. And because he has a weapon and she does not, he got the best of her. I think that at some point she put up a fight or was not going to go along with whatever it was that he wanted to do. And the result is what we have, this fight that took place, a fight to the death. And unfortunately she lost because She was smaller. She did not have a weapon. And yeah, I think.
Well, I think if he was more sophisticated, that once he got her to wherever he was wanting to take her, that he could then, if he was more sophisticated, that he would either have a better plan or he'd be able to continue to be able to manipulate her better.
Kill her in a different manner is what you're saying, instead of the manner in which she was killed, which seems sort of like a sporadic type of, like Nick said, reactionary type of killing. And I do.
Yeah, or just to be able to convince her that, you know, things are going to be okay. That you're not, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or that I'm okay, you know, you don't need to worry about me.
Yeah. And again, speaking to Nick's comment about him being, getting the better of her, of course he's an adult, a male adult, and he's fighting a child. I mean, that blunt force trauma to the head easily could have knocked her out. And then he just stabbed her three times in the neck and she just bled out wherever she was. And I know that's a lot of graphic information, but it's what the autopsy says.
But again, it could be, and I hate to agree with Nick, but some level of criminal sophistication, because okay, you have, I hit her with whatever object, okay, take off her clothes, put her in a tub, and the stab wounds are for her to bleed out. I mean, you said it hit her artery.
Yeah.
And again, you're in country that these, there's a lot of people around there that understand how that works. Now, maybe more so on an animal, but it's not that far removed.
It all works. It all works the same. I mean, what do you think, Nick, about the hunting aspect, as far as, you know, people down in that area knowing exactly pretty much what to do if you needed to get rid of blood out of a deer or whatever you were hunting that day?
Well, I don't know that I necessarily think that the intention was to remove that amount of blood from the body. I think it's just kind of happenstance that this was an attack. When you picture a fight,
okay,
go down, you don't always land the punches where you want to. And I'm saying punches rather than stabs. I think that it happened that he hit the artery and the fight continued from there and she bled out. Mostly in that manner is what I think probably went down. I absolutely believe that there was some type of secondary location. I think that there was a place that he had that was private, that he knew that they could be alone. And I think that it's not so much necessarily, hey, you don't have to worry about me physically harming you. I think it's more about, we're now going to do something that you do not want to do, regardless of what the result is. And I think that was what the decision that Amy made. Whatever this is, I'm not going along with it. And I'm willing to fight this grown-up who is armed because I'm not going along with what's going down here.
Well, no. And so do you think it's possible that declothed in either to have a sexual act, or is she declothed and he washes her clothes because she was covered in blood?
That's kind of exactly where I was thinking, or my mind was going, with the amount of blood and the fact that, yeah, that might not have been the goal, you know, to get rid of the blood, but may have been an end result. But maybe it was the goal, because he's going to have to now transport this individual. If he killed her in the car is ruined. I mean, the car is that you're going to have to torch the car. You're going to have somebody that, you know, demo the car, Breaking Bad style.
Right. We're talking 8 ounces or
yeah,
more of blood.
You can't clean that up
at the spot
yeah,
of the murder.
And
And you'd think some of that's going to get on our clothes. And like you said, there's not a lot of blood.
I mean,
it's
not, again, like
the autopsy does not read in the way that would make you believe that there was a lot of blood on the clothes. There was some blood.
It didn't seem like
not enough to have more than 60% of the blood from the body.
Yeah, it definitely didn't drain. Oh God, it sounds terrible. It definitely did not, you know, happen there, in my opinion. I think that the reason for the redressing, yeah, it was probably sexually related as far as why she was unclothed to begin with. But once he realized he was going to have to transport a body covered in blood.
Well, and to really echo what you and the captain are saying, I also think the redressing is for several reasons. And, you know, we don't need to list all of them, but one, simply for the purpose of this stuff is evidence. I do not want this found in my hunting cabin that I own or my trailer that I own. That will not look good for me. So I need to dispose of this evidence as well as this body. And I think it's also in a weird way, please don't send me any hate mail, but this is a true, real thing. It's also some form of remorse shown by the killer redress the victim. And I think that that's something that he purposely did. What level of understanding he has of that, we will never know. And who really cares? But I think it's something that was purposely done. And I think that psychologically on some in some way, it's a form of remorse. And that goes back to, he had some level of, and it's hard to say these words, but he had some form of care for, he had some emotion toward this, towards
it's
the victim.
It's very reminiscent of Oakland County.
But I actually think it's the complete opposite. And this is very weird. For this is going to be a weird path, but hold my hand and let's go down it together.
No, thank you.
With Oakland County, one thing I've always suspected in those cases is that the reason why they go, well, these kids look like they were held for a period of time. They were appeared to be well kept, cleaned, well fed. Why? And the thought was that, you know, they nicknamed the killer the babysitter killer because it was somebody that was showing care and compassion for their victim. And then there was also thought of, well, he's cleaning the victim and cleaning the clothing to get rid of evidence for evidentiary purposes. I actually think that it is some of that on some level, but I also think that those children, this is some really dark, disturbing stuff. I think they were being rewarded for things that they probably did not want to do. I actually think that the fried chicken that the Kid King ate, I don't think that that was a taunt to the parents or taunt to the police. I think that that was a reward for him doing something that he did not want to do. I think what happened in Amy's case is, I think that she didn't care about the rewards. And at some point she fought back, and this is the result. And yeah, I don't think that, I think there's probably some of the same similar ideals and thoughts by these very different killers, but I think that it went the opposite way very quickly in the Amy case.
Well, Nick said the word remorse, which is probably not the word I would have used, but I think they're tied. Also, a level of respect, and just like he said, like he cared, this individual cared for her. So I think it is a sign of remorse, but I think it's also oddly a sign of respect that he wasn't going to have her found in the nude. And maybe that's also why he didn't bury her, because he felt that was disrespectful as well.
I agree with that. And as far as wanting the body to be discovered, I think if there was a sense of care there, then that would have been one way of showing some sense of care in this completely warped world we're discussing, as far as somebody making that as a way to make things better. But
I think the body placement was more out of necessity.
I think it was too.
I think it was easy, convenient. And I'm with the captain, though. Captain's spot on.
I think
it
was a little panic.
If he would have buried her somewhere in the middle of nowhere, we would have we would have a whole lot of less evidence.
And he could have done that anytime. That's the thing. Like, he could have gone back to the site if he needed to. He knows where he left the body. We know previous serial killers that have well, not that this isn't necessarily a serial killer, but Bundy used to go back to see the victims. The Green River Killer would go back to see the victims. I mean, this isn't an uncommon thing. He could have gone back and buried her if he had the desire to do so. I don't know if that was...
Again, criminal sophistication. I think this is where he dropped the ball. That I think, like I said, I think this individual was fantasizing about a lot of things, but when it came to the end or the closure of whatever he was going to do, I don't think he sat around and fantasized about that. I don't think he got off on that. I think he got off on the idea that he was going to be able to capture this individual and to be alone with her and then get her to another place. I think these were all fantasies that motivated him. And that's what he thought about. That's why it seems to go according to plan, according to plan, according to plan. All of a sudden, oh shit, what did I do? And I think the placement of the body was again, maybe has a decent criminal mind, but is panicked. And that's why, you know, because anybody, I think, with some level of understanding of crime would go, place her in the woods, bury her somewhere else, put her in water. There's a lot of things that you could do. But I also think maybe that is, you know, like you were saying, I'm placing the body here because I want it to be discovered. And maybe there's a part of them, part of this individual that wants to be discovered himself, because he knows that these thoughts are, and these urges are not.
If you're listening, call the Bay Village Police Department and turn yourself in. Now, the thing...
Well, he's probably dead.
The thing is, I think that the fantasy, for the fantasy to play out, he has to be able to maintain a certain level of control. And once that level of control ceases to exist, that's when the murder and the fight takes place. And the captain's absolutely right. There was no planning beyond that fantasy, that sexual fantasy, because he failed to recognize the variable of the human element, of the will to not be a victim. And Amy fought back. And so his lack of planning for that variable, everything went off the rails then and there. And that's where the plan stopped, because he never planned for her not to be controlled by him.
Yeah, because I think on some level, because he wanted it so bad and it was a desire of his, that he thought she would as well.
Yeah.
Once I get her here and once this is happening, she'll enjoy this as much as me.
That's exactly
that,
the
delusion. Or he'll be able to control her, so it doesn't matter if she enjoys or not.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I think by, just the control, once he lost control of the situation, I think it was, you know, the decision was made. But I think this also leads me to believe that he probably hasn't committed any other murder. If this was, you know, he had a desire to, like, okay, fantasies don't have, they always have happy endings, right? So no surprise he doesn't have a plan for the end of this fantasy, because he sees it all working out. I'm going to abduct this girl. Maybe his plan is that she's going to be in love with him and that they'll have a relationship and yada, yada, yada. But we don't know that for a fact. But what we do know is that the reason that she's dead is because the plan didn't go according to plan. And that's a fact. And we can't discount that. And I think with where her body was found, you mentioned it being a panicked spot. Okay. I think, yes, he could have taken her further, but I feel like he got her far enough away. Like he just wanted to get rid of her and not be involved with it anymore. Like, I think that, and I think it's just pure luck that he has gotten away with it for as long as he has.
I think possibly, but, or possibly again, I don't think this guy was a dummy. I think you just take average level of intelligence, maybe a little less, but this guy would have known, put her in the woods. Or, but we see time after time with Bundy, with Dahmer, with a bunch of other killers, even child killers, where there's such a remorse afterwards. And their thought is, oh, I'm never going to do this again. I'm never going to let these urges get out of control ever again. Or I think I can control the urges. I can still have them, but I'll control them. But I think there is a level of, you know, I'll place her here so she'll be found. I'm going to do so in as respectable of a manner as I can. I got to do it in a place where I'm not going to get caught. But there's a part of him that knows by her body being found that he could get caught then.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, as far as the location goes, I think that's just, he knew the area, in my opinion. I think he could have probably done a better job hiding her, but I don't think that that was his goal.
Right. But I think in some way that might point out the, again, one thing that I've always kind of thought, that I think that the connection between her and him, victim and perpetrator, is very thin. That there is not much of a breadcrumb trail at all. And I think that the deciding to leave her out in the open where she would be found, I think that indicates that as well. I think that if there was an easy line that you could draw between her and him, he would have went to much greater lengths of getting rid of the body given the opportunity.
Now, I've got a couple questions. I know Nick's got a roll here in a little bit. So I just wanted to ask, do you guys have any thoughts on whether or not this could be connected to Mark? You know, because he traveled a ton. And, you know, you run into some, I don't know, I'm not going to say shady characters, but, you know, working in a service department, you can be anybody. And he was a sales rep. And there were a lot of different dealerships, and he was out of town for a dealership conference that day. Do you think there's any connection to those dealers at all? Because, I mean,
I think the problem with that would be that I think you would see different sets of wounds, you know, maybe more stabbings, because then it'd be more personable. It's more. Like, are you saying like that?
Like, my thought is that he's discussed her with people, shown a picture of her. Somebody's like, oh, you know, got a crush on her and decided that he was going to call her, but didn't know her. And then used the ruse as they're working with her mom as, no, I actually work with my dad, or work with your dad. That's where I'm going with that. Nick, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, so, I mean, it's an interesting avenue, and it's something I know that they did explore, they being law enforcement, and it's the right thing to do. I mean, his circle of his social circle as far as work relationships go would have been much greater than that of Margaret. One, because of his position, and two, as you stated, he travels around and meets with these different locations, and that's a large part of his job at the time. And Mark Mihaljevic himself has been on record stating, you know, I've always wondered if and when we catch this guy, is it going to be someone that I go, oh, wait, I know him from here. I just never made the connection because it's not in my immediate circle. It's not even on my secondary circle or the third, but it's somebody that, oh, maybe we had a company picnic together and I remember talking to him, or it's somebody that I would come across from time to time at, on my travels for work. So, I mean, he has said it himself. I think that all possibilities are certainly on the table, regardless of my theory that I don't think that Amy knew this guy.
Well, I don't think it necessarily implies that she knew him. Right. I think it just implies that he knew her, and that's really all this takes.
Right.
And the reason why I kind of bring up the dealership aspect of it is it's just like, it's simple to go, you know, you're not telling a full lie. You do work with one of her parents. So it's easier not to lie. And
I've said from the get, if you can figure out how he knows her, but she does not know him, that is your fastest freeway that you can put your cop car on and lead you right to the killer.
Yeah. And I did have Mark tell me that straight to my face, he thinks he'll know the person when the person's finally found. And that's just disturbing.
But I think it's like a distance thing. Like you said, it could be a mechanic at one of the dealerships.
That's what I'm talking about. You know,
and that's why, you know, when they talked about the suspect that worked at the horse stables, I always mm-hmm. thought, again, it's somebody that has a little bit of connection with her, a little bit of interaction enough to want to have a relationship with her.
Yeah. Now, Nick, we mentioned it before and you said you wanted to get back to it. The fact that there haven't been any suspects named by authorities, only by bloggers and true crime authors such as Ronnie.
Damn bloggers.
Bloggers and podcasters and whatnot. What do you make of that? I mean, is there a reason, a method for their madness there? Or is it the fact that they really just don't have anybody?
I think that it's a sign that they don't have anything very strong indicating one individual in particular. I think it's responsible. I think it's also a method that will not hinder the investigation further. That I don't think they want the public thinking, oh, we know who did this, we just can't prove it. And I think what we have here, we do have in some roundabout ways of law enforcement naming suspects, if you will. I mean, we have Robert Ressler, who straight up said Billy Strunack did this in his book. Now, mind you, he didn't actively work the case more than for 24 or 48 hours. And he wrote about it in his book years later. We do have Bay Village Police Department on record in the papers saying that they wanted to speak with Frank Denis, or Denise, if I'm saying his name right, D-I-E-N-E-S.
Dienis. Frank Dienis.
Yeah, Frank Dienis, and in relation to Amy's case. Now, that doesn't mean that he's a suspect in their eyes, but he was.
He did do work at their house, yeah.
He was enough to the point that they publicly stated he's somebody we want to speak with. Now, the other thing, though, too, Spetzel, and you know this from personal experience, Bill, that he's not shied away from talking about individuals if directly asked about them. But I think the thing here is that what scares me is that I think that it shows that they're not a whole heck of a lot closer to who they think that it is today. I think that they probably very likely have crossed some people off of their list with a maybe not 100% certainty, but a 99% certainty. We just kind of touched on Holly Hill and Harold Bound. I'm going off of memory. I believe his name is mm-hmm. Harold Bound.
Yep.
He was investigated pretty extensively for a long period of time, and they couldn't really find much in the way of evidence to directly connect him to this. There are still some question marks surrounding that individual for certain. But yeah, it is interesting that 31 years later, that seems to be the case. And it's a bit disconcerting. We did cover the case several times on True Crime Garage. You know, we've done over 400 episodes, And the most recent time we spoke about this was a year ago, roughly a year ago today, when we released episodes 345 and 346. And it's titled Amy Mihaljevic Suspects. And it's kind of funny that we covered it months and months before with the idea that we were going to discuss suspects. And the case, believe it or not, is so large and such a long story to tell that we spoke for 2 hours on the case without naming any suspects and then had to come back to it in episodes 345 and 346. And I think that we probably named four or five, if I'm remembering correctly. I do have a top 10 list of suspects that I like.
You go all the way up to 10?
Yeah. And I would like to get back to doing to releasing the other five, because I have two on there that I think people will find to be very surprising. And maybe at some point we'll get back to doing this. I did say, though, and this was kind of a personal thing, I did tell myself last November that I had sworn myself off of Amy's case and that I was never going to look at it again. And I'm not going to lie to you.
Like what Renner does.
Well, I don't know what Renner does, but in this particular case, it's just, if you've seen the movie The Zodiac, where Robert Graysmith, he's holed up in his house and he's surrounded by boxes and his wife and children leave him.
Right.
I feel like I've been close to that point on this case a couple of times, and it's not doing anybody any good, and it's actually detrimental to a lot of other things that I'm trying to do that are good things.
And I'm not talking bad about Renner. I just know that with like Mara's case, several times he said, I'm not discussing the Mara Murray case anymore. I'm not going to be actively looking into it anymore. A couple of times said he's not going to even be actively adding to the blog. The problem with some of these cases is they seep into your blood, and there's no escaping it. You're going to constantly keep coming back. My issue with the suspects, which have been named in blogs, podcasters, and books and stuff like that, is, again, we have created this narrative. There's the one individual that, you know, who's the guy that had the trailer, worked at the search center for Amy?
Strunack.
Yeah, Gabe. Wait.
Well, Strunack worked at the center with the Amy Center.
Yeah, I think you might be meshing two people
together. I think was it Harold Bound that lived in the trailer, right?
Well, Bound lived on the
That's right. He lived on the Holly Hill property.
He lived in the Holly Hill property.
Who's the one that committed suicide?
Strunack.
Okay, so that
he lived in an apartment.
And a lot of people have stated
in another town, actually, the town over.
That he couldn't have actually done the crime because they didn't believe he was that violent.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different things that have come up about Strunack. And again, the fact that Wrestler interviewed him or whatever he did with him for 24 hours and somehow was able to, hey, we think it's this guy. And then for literally until James wrote another book about it or started writing about it and seen, it was kind of pushed to the back burner because basically people just figured, it had to be that Strunack guy. Or remember the crazy guy that ran into the church and said, I killed Amy Mihaljevic. And
right. No, it's weird because nowhere in Wrestler's book is there the actual sentence of Billy Strunack killed Amy Mihaljevic. But there's several sentences that say that he did in Wrestler's opinion, and without putting those actual words in the same sentence together. And it's weird because when he first starts to lead down that path in his book of telling that story, and he says, hey, I'm helping out, I believe it was Agent Dunn, who was a longtime friend of Wrestler's and who was a field agent in Cleveland and was actively working the Mihaljevic case and probably doing some really darn good work on it. He says, you know, I sat down with these guys because I happened to be in town for something else work related. And I sat down with these guys, we're going over the case and I'm drawing up a profile of the offender. And when we're done reviewing the case and I release my, this is very CBS Criminal Minds stuff right here, where he says, you know, I release my profile to Dunn and to the other agent that was working the case at the time. They said, okay, well, we have a list of suspects. And I can't remember if it was 7, 8, or 10 suspects that they were pretty good on, that they liked for this, that they couldn't cross off their list. He says in the book that they said that two of them fit that profile. Billy Strunack fits it to a T. And then they go and they interview Strunack in his apartment. And what I've always been curious about is, who was that other guy? Who was the other one that fit the profile that wasn't named and didn't fit it to a T? But who was that other guy? And where have we gone with him? And it, what's completely weird about the whole wrestler thing is that years later, you have Dunn who says, yeah, I don't think Strunack did it. And Wrestler thought so much that Strunack did it that he put it in his book.
It's like literally like stepping on somebody's work, in my opinion. I mean, Dunn's here doing the hard work of investigating. He knows the case. And then Wrestler is kind of like, I'm going to fly in for my cameo appearance. And here's my 2 cents on it. Here's my signature. Have a great day.
In Wrestler's defense, the weird thing was, you know, the story of his family, Strunack's family, cleaning out his apartment. I've actually spoke to one individual that claims to have lived in the same apartment building and told me that it was like a 24-hour or less turnaround of the guy died and his family cleaned out his apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a little bizarre. We're not even going to take the time to mourn the loss of our loved one. Let's get in there, get his shit out of here, and put some fresh paint on the walls.
Maybe they knew he was a piece of shit. I don't know.
Or yeah,
want that security deposit.
Well, that's my issue though, is, and that's something I question the work that we're doing or trying to do, is if you're too dismissive of an idea or a theory. Are there individuals, you know, like in the Amy case, where this week one of Amy's friends was at my house talking about the case? She's listened to several episodes. Is there anything that she knew or thought she knew that she has dismissed because she listened to or read some kind of publication? And I think there's probably a lot of people, maybe even eyewitnesses at the scene that maybe have never come forward, but later have investigated the case on their own, and they get Renner's book and Renner dismisses somebody or listens to our podcast and we dismiss an idea. And then they go, oh, well, that makes logical sense. I'm going to dismiss what I saw too.
Yeah. I can see how that could be a disservice to the investigation.
Well, and Renner's book doesn't really dismiss anybody.
Yeah, he kind of leaves the door open. And the funny thing,
he actually just points out about 5 or 6 good suspects that he thinks are good suspects and kind of leaves it open ended. There are a couple points where he will reference something that was said to him that so and so didn't like someone for this, and here's why.
Right. No, and I'm not trying to point the finger at him. I'm just using him as an example. It's a published a piece about the case. And I think a lot of times listeners or people are interested in a case, they go, oh, well, it's published, so then everything here is fact. Or this is a podcast that I agree with, so everything that they're saying here is fact. So I think, again, it might not even be dismissing. It could just be spending more time on the guy that you think is more interesting and less time on this guy. And I just wonder how much that has affected maybe anybody coming forward, especially in a case like this. It's 31 years old. And I think the same way with like the Mara Murray case. I think there's probably some people that know more than they've ever told people publicly, but they might have jumped and listened to a podcast 5 or 6 times and went, oh, maybe I didn't see what I saw.
A couple of final questions before we go, because I know Nick's got some stuff he's got to do. But, you know, now that Spetzel's retired and Torsny's not as involved as he was, what do you want to see happen with the investigation, or who would you like to see take over the special investigation of the case?
Just make Nick and Renner do it.
Well, I mean, I personally, I prefer Spetzel because he's been there since the beginning, and I know that he's been itching to get back to the investigation side of things. If he took over, would you guys feel confident about that?
Yes. And actually, I think you kind of answered it the way that I was going to answer it. You know, who should take over the investigation with Torsny done with, you know, retired, fully retired, and now Spetzel retired. And my answer is the Bay Village Police Department. And I know that sounds like a duh answer. Yes, they've been working it for 31 years, but you know, Torsny, as accomplished as he is and as brilliant, I don't want to take anything away from that individual. He's done a lot in his law enforcement career. But this is not the case that I don't think it gets solved with somebody driving down here one weekend a month. I feel like this needs to be put in the lap of someone that has a Bay Village badge on their chest. And I think that if I were in charge, if I were the chief of police, and I understand Spetzel, when you are the chief of police, there's a lot of administrative duties that take over the large portion of your job. You're overseeing the entire police force in that area. I get that. What I would do is I would put somebody, my best guy on this or best girl on this, and I would make it personal for them. Somebody that can wake up and go to sleep every night and eat and breathe and live this case, because I think that it's going to take somebody that is a part of that community and probably has been for the majority of their lives to have a complete understanding of the case itself. And again, nothing to take away from how brilliant Torsny is, but this is not going to be solved by some weekend warrior. And
it's a kind of pound the pavement.
It's a pound the pavement thing. And if I were in charge of Bay Village Police Department, look, top priority is to protect and serve the community and uphold the safety level of the community. This is not a poor area at all. The taxes are not cheap there. If they don't have a cold case unit, they should get one, or at least get one individual, very smart individual, and put them in charge of the cold case, in charge of cold cases. And this one needs to be at the top of the stack, because there's really, in this community, there's been no other bigger crime other than that of the Sam Shepard case. But look at a whole.
Right, but is that you implying that you think it's local?
No, what I'm trying to imply is that I think that it takes a local mind and a local understanding to be the one to finally solve this thing. Maybe it's not. Maybe it is, because here's the vibe that I feel like I'm getting when we hear from law enforcement on this case. There's two things. One, we keep getting told time and time again how quote unquote solvable this case is. Well, is that really freaking true? Because it's been 31 years. Is it really solvable? Is it that much solvable that you've supposedly had the FBI and Bay Village Police Department working arm in arm for 31 years and we've not solved it? Or is it just, we're really just waiting on the technology to catch up with this case? And that's, and maybe that's what they're doing, but frankly, that's not good enough for me. And I don't know. It is a very difficult case. There's a lot of people that say that, you know, it's so unique of a case that this is the only time anywhere. There's never been another case like it where someone calls somebody on the phone and lures somebody somewhere. And that's just not true. Yeah, I brought it up on your show before, Allison Perot. We looked at that case in good depth. And that was the exact same. Yeah, my bad. But that's the exact same MO. And in fact, I've been reviewing a case that is somewhat well known here in the greater Columbus area, that the same MO was used in that case. Mm. And what did we see in the Perot case? It was, in fact, technology that solved that case. They didn't have any, they didn't have the lead that led them to the individual. And in the case that I'm talking about in Columbus, right, it wasn't closed until the suspect was dead. And he was probably a suspect at some point during that case, but they took somebody to trial and it was not him.
Question for you, the distance between the plaza and where she was found.
About 50 miles.
48.3, I think, is so, what the FBI said it was.
So I actually think this, and then this would probably take a miracle. It would take somebody with a very intelligent person that decided to look into this case, but just so happened to be from wherever this individual was, and possibly where the spot that he took Amy, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I mean,
because I don't know if this was local, so it's like, yeah, you have eyewitnesses at the plaza, but maybe the plaza is too important. Or people are making the plaza too important. They're making the eyewitness statements from the plaza.
Well, it's like they say the sketch, just throw that out the window. I mean, basically, I mean, right. I've had the chief tell me that. Don't even bother.
But the sketch, I mean, does tell us something. And what it does
something,
tell us, right, no, and I get that. But what it does tell us is this person is either local or fits the bill of somebody that would be local. He didn't.
Was dressed right, like
he didn't
a local
stand out. This was not, you know, some Charles Manson looking long hair, beard, 5'3" with a swastika on his forehead. This is not somebody that put off any alarm bells or raised any red flags. He was somebody that fit the background of the environment that he was in, be it if he is from that background or put himself there. Now, so it does tell us that. And right. Bill, I think you're absolutely spot on. Is this person local? My answer is yes, but I say that it's probably either is or was local to the extent of Northeast Ohio. And then I'm with you. I think that if this was a Bay Village guy, he was wearing a disguise that day because it would be, he wouldn't have been able to go anywhere.
Yeah. 17,000 is very tiny.
And it's very close knit. This is not like 17,000 in like a rural area. This is 17,000 in a very tight knit suburb.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with everything, you know, let's just wrap this up. With everything that's been done, you guys have done so many shows. Nick and I were both on the Lake Erie Murders and the ID channel.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, you know, I unfortunately didn't have the strings to pull with the director on that one. But I'll say this, you know, is there anything we're not doing that we could be doing to help? I mean, I feel like we're kind of doing everything. Is there anything else that we're missing?
Well, again, that's what I worry about, this the true crime space, and not maybe for us, and I'm just saying everybody, podcasters, authors, people making documentaries, be careful about dismissing certain things. Or changing the narrative, because it really could stop somebody from coming forward. If I thought I knew something about a case and then I did a little bit of digging and I found two or three people stating whatever thing was stupid and given logical reasons, because a lot of the people like you, Bill and Nick, you guys are intelligent people. So when you come up with a theory and you have some room to back it up, I think it could stop some people from coming forward. And I just think that's something maybe moving forward that maybe the whole community could, you know, take shape of, if that makes any sense.
Well, and you asked totally. The question, is there something that we're missing? And the clear answer to me is 100% yes. You know, we keep hearing how solvable this case is. And I do think that it is solvable. Now, am I losing hope? Yes, a little more every year. I absolutely am. But I think I still think that it's solvable. But here's the question that I asked myself. And I think the captain was, you know, talking about this much earlier in our conversation today. There's a very good chance that this case might be, there's a little more complicated than it appears on the surface. And maybe that's why, in fact, it has not been solved. to this day. And what are we missing? Well, we're clearly missing something because we've not solved it. I don't know what that is, but the questions that I would really focus on that I think that will lead you or shrink your suspect pool a bit are very simple. Look at what this individual was able to control. We talked so much in this show about his fantasy, the script he was writing with that fantasy. And that means he has to be able to uphold a certain level of control of himself, of his environment, and the victim. So when everything was in his control, these were all things that he had decided and chosen in advance. Why? Why did he make those decisions? Why did he choose the options that he chose? And that's what's going to really lead you to this guy. Because as far as physical evidence goes, we've beat that horse to death, or we're waiting on technology to catch up to that evidence. So if we're going to sit here and just sit on our, you can just sit here and sit on your hands if you want and wait for technology, or you can start answering some of these questions. Why Amy? He called her house. He wasn't cold calling, looking for donations or to sell you car insurance. He called her. Why Amy? Why the Plaza? Why that Friday? Those are all three things that he controlled when he spoke to that little girl and that she, you know, unfortunately went along with.
And still leaves so many unanswered questions. And, you know, just with those three things, it's just like you can just spin your wheels on those alone. Yeah, this case is, I think, like you said, it's solvable, but I do think it is more complicated than maybe they are letting on, and they maybe that's why they have kept some things close to the vest.
Maybe they know that.
Yeah. And you know, I feel like what you guys have done, and you know, just the involvement that we've given and attention given to this case, I really think that that's the best way to, you know, keep a story in the spotlight. Is, as John Walsh always used to say, you have to be the biggest cheerleader for, you know, if you lose a family member, you have to keep the story in the news. So she's not a family member to us, but she's definitely something that, she's a person that impacted our lives as kids, and I think will always be connected to this case.
Yeah, I hope that they have something that they're either waiting on a test, or they're currently testing, or going through a list similar to what some people are doing now with the JonBenet Ramsey case. We have a list of suspects that are 20, 30 deep, maybe in this case. And so going by one by one and trying to find ways to test, you know, whether it's DNA samples or whatever it would be.
Yeah. I know that they are waiting on technology. They have said that. And I hope that they're not just waiting on technology.
Right.
So Nick, I know you've got a role. You've got a big, busy day ahead of you. And, the captain, man, what a pleasure to have both of you guys on Who Killed. This is an absolute delight. And I think that you guys definitely have your own opinions on this case. And I think the listeners will definitely pick up on that. So I can't thank you enough. So thanks a lot for joining me this week.
Thanks, Bill.
Thanks guys.
For having us.
Yeah, have a great weekend.
You too.
All right, bye.
Thank you so much to Nick and the captain of the True Crime Garage podcast for all the time they've put into Amy's case, as well as joining me this week. As a reminder, I do drop new episodes of Who Killed every Friday wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Anyone with information regarding Amy's murder should contact the Bay Village Police Department at 440-871-1234 or the FBI at 1-800-CALL-FBI. We all want resolution for the Mihaloviks and for the community. If you have any information regarding any of the other unsolved cases I have covered, you can also use the 1-800-CALL-FBI phone number. For the second year in a row, I was supposed to be representing Who Killed Amy Mihaloviks and my passion case on Podcast Row at CrimeCon 2020. But we had a pandemic. The event is now a virtual event and is called CrimeCon House Arrest.
and it will be held November 21st from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. Tickets can be purchased at crimecon.com/housearrest. You can use my promo code AMY2020 to save 10% on your ticket. If you enjoy this podcast and my other shows, you can help support independent journalism by clicking the donate button on the left-hand side of slowburnmedia.com or via PayPal with my username BillHuffman123@yahoo.com or via Venmo with my username at Bill-Huffman-3. Every contribution does help keep these Slow Burn podcasts running. And again, if you want to support the show by leaving a 5-star review, that helps keep the show in the spotlight and it helps keep cases like Amy's out there in the public. If you'd like to stay up to date on what I have coming down the pipeline, please follow me on Twitter at BillHuffman3. Thank you guys so much again for listening. And until next time, be healthy and stay safe.
Hello, this is Dr. Grande, the host of True Crime Psychology and Personality. On my podcast, I explore and explain the pathology behind some of the most horrendous crimes and those who commit them. We discuss topics like narcissism, psychopathy, sociopathy, and antisocial personality disorder from a scientifically informed perspective. What is a narcissist? How do you spot a sociopath? What signs can you look for to protect yourself from these dangerous personalities? It's not just about the stories, but also the science and psychology behind them. So if you're interested in true crime or mental health, I'd encourage you to give my show a listen wherever you get podcasts.
Are you tired of seeing your teen or young adult struggle on a path that clearly isn't the right fit? Is your teenager confused about which direction to take after high school? The future of work is changing rapidly. And our kids need to know all of the options available after high school so they're empowered to make the choice that is best for them. In each episode, we explore the latest trends that are shaping the opportunities of today and tomorrow. I'm your host, Betsy Jewell, and this is the High School Hamster Wheel Podcast.